This is Lecture 14 on Deuteronomy by Robert Vinoy. Lecture 14. Let's go back to our discussion. We were discussing centralization of worship issues. Last week, we looked at the place of centralization of worship in Wellhausen's reconstruction of Israel's religious development. What we want to do, which is capital B on your sheet, was a suggested response to Wellhausen's view of the centralization of worshiping in ancient Israel. Now, what I'm going to do initially here is give you pretty much the way in which Halwarda has argued against Wellhausen's position. If you look in your bibliography, page 5, at the bottom of the page, you'll see centralization of worship in Deuteronomy, and you notice the fourth entry there is Halwarda's. It's a Dutch article that's translated as "The Place the Lord Shall Choose." That article has not been translated into English yet. I think it's quite a good article, and much of what I'll say here is pretty much the way he develops his thesis from that article. Halwarda mentions that in the history of opposition to Wellhausen's theory, most of the objections are directed against various details of the system as a whole. You see, here is Wellhausen's system, and you get critics of the system to focus on this detail or that detail or some other detail, but a lot of the opposition of Wellhausen's system has been directed against various details of his system. But what Halwarda argues is that it should be realized that the centralization of worship is the key point in Wellhausen's whole system. In other words, if you are going to get at the Wellhausen system, that centralization of worship issue is the key issue in this whole system that needs to be taken up and discussed. Halwarda says, when you look at the Old Testament, you notice quite quickly that in the historical books that cover the time from the Judges up to and including the time of the kingdom, you repeatedly find multiplicity of altars referred to. That being the case, multiplicity of altars from the time of Judges up to the kingdom period, he says, that it's hardly satisfactory to say that worship at these altars was illegal or illegitimate in all these places where reference is made in the scriptures to worship apart from worship at the tabernacle or later at the temple. Now, he says, of course, there are examples of worship that were illegitimate, that were not in conformity with the Mosaic laws. For example, in Judges 17, you'll recall the story of a fellow named Micah who had these household idols, and the Danites came, and they take these idols and migrate north with Micah's idols and his Levite. They then set up a place of worship there at Dan, and they set up an altar as well. Certainly that worship was illegitimate. It goes against the requirements of the Mosaic law. We also have the complaint about Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, when you read the books of Kings. Every king of the north, it says, made Israel sin at the worship sites of Dan and Bethel, where there were golden calves and altars. And again, these altars and the worship of the calves were contrary to Mosaic law. Now, what Halwarda thinks the issue is not so much that there was an altar in the north, which would have been legitimate, but there was golden calf worship, which was certainly a violation of the second commandment. And that commandment says, "You shall not make unto thyself any image or any likeness of anything." So you can find examples of worship and altars that were illegitimate. But you also find many for which there is no condemnation made. There are very godly people who are sacrificing at these altars, and it seems to be perfectly legitimate. So in that period, from Judges through the kingdom, it seems like the multiplicity of altars is not condemned per se. An illustration Halwarda brings out, and I think this is an important one, is in the ministry of Elijah. Remember, Elijah confronted Ahab at Mount Carmel. In the process, he restored an altar of the Lord that had been broken down. Then you have that contest between the Lord, Yahweh, and Baal. The Lord answered Elijah's prayer, and fire came from heaven and lit that altar as a demonstration of the existence and power of Yahweh over and against Baal, who couldn't do anything. Certainly, that was an altar apart from the altar of the temple. That was subsequent to the time that the temple had been built. Rather than condemnations of this as another altar, it seems the Lord sanctioned that altar in the north in the time of Elijah and Ahab. Later, Helwarda says, I think this is in the context where Elijah is discouraged as he is fleeing from Jezebel, that's in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 10, after he fled all the way down to Mount Horeb. And we read, the word of the Lord says to him, what are you doing here? And he replies, I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant and, get this, broken down your altars and put your prophets to death with a sword. I am the only one left. You see, Elijah's complaint is not that there were too many altars, but that the Israelites were breaking down the altars of the Lord and were not using the altars of the Lord. They weren't paying attention to the prophets. Notice what he says, they have broken down your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with a sword. So, someone could argue that has nothing to do with legality of sacrifices having been brought to Jerusalem, or the legality of those brought elsewhere than Jerusalem. But that doesn't really seem like an adequate response to this issue. It seems that certainly that there weren't any problems with altars apart from Jerusalem. I think the issue is an issue that's been created by Wellhausen and those people who have chosen to follow him. It seems like to Elijah, the multiplicity of altars was no issue. It was just accepted that there were a lot of altars that are centered all over Jerusalem, but there are a lot of other altars as well in other parts of the country. It wasn't that there was some history of progression from many altars to one. That seems like a concept that is totally foreign to Elijah. Now, of course, there were altars on high places, but I'll just say this at this point, and we'll come back and look at that in more detail. It seems that some of the high places were illegitimate because they were taken over from the Canaanites, which was specifically prohibited. It seems that some of the other high places were places of worship to the Lord. In fact, that's specifically said in certain cases. There seems to be nothing wrong with that. But it does seem that at the high places, gradually you begin to get this sort of syncretistic kind of worship and confusion between Baal worship and worship of the Lord. At that point, this kind of worship became wrong. So you get those kings in the south of which it is said something like they did good in the eyes of the Lord. And we're referring to kings like Josiah and Hezekiah. Now, Josiah did tear down altars. Asa and Hezekiah did good in the eyes of the Lord, except we are told they did not tear down the high places. That seems like something that was sort of a blotch on their reigns to some extent. They should have torn them down. But then the question is, why should they have torn them down? Is it because there was an altar in Jerusalem? That could be one possible answer. Or is it because there was heathen worship going on there? I'm inclined to this latter part. Or was this syncretistic worship? We'll come back to that as well. The books of Samuel are particularly important with respect to this question. Samuel was certainly a prophet of the Lord, a reformer. He called the people back to the Lord and away from heathen worship. He built a number of altars at different places. In chapter 9 of 1 Samuel, you read in verse 12, when Saul is looking out for his lost donkeys, and his servant says, let's go inquire from this man of God, Samuel the seer. Verse 12 says, when they come down to the town and ask if there is a seer there, the response is, he is there, but he's ahead of you. Hurry now, he is just coming to our town today, for the people will have a sacrifice at the high place. And as you read down through that chapter, you find Samuel goes and officiates at the sacrifice located at the high place. Verse 13, and I'm quoting here, as soon as you enter the town, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. The people will not begin eating until he comes, because he must bless the sacrifice. Afterwards, those who are invited will eat. Go up now, and you should find him about this time." End quote. And then verse 19 says, "I am the seer." This is Samuel's reply. And he says, "Go up ahead with me to the high place, for today you are to eat with me, and in the morning I will let you go and tell you all that is in your heart." And then verse 25 says, "After they came down from the high place into the town, Samuel talked with Saul on the roof of the house," and so forth. So it seems quite clear that Samuel's sacrificing, and that there was the sacrificial meal that Saul partook of at Ramah. In 1 Samuel chapter 7, verse 6, Samuel sacrifices at Mizpah. We read, "When they assembled at Mizpah, they drew out water and poured it out before the Lord. On that day they fasted, and they confessed, 'We have sinned against the Lord.' Samuel was the leader of Israel at Mizpah." End quote. And then verse 9 we read, "Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it up as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. He cried out to the Lord on Israel's behalf, and the Lord answered him." That's another place where he sacrificed. Chapter 11, Samuel does it at Gilgal. In 1 Samuel 11, verse 15, Samuel says, "Let's go to Gilgal and reaffirm the kingship." So all the people went on to Gilgal and confirmed Saul as king in the presence of the Lord. They sacrificed fellowship offerings. Samuel went to these various places, so certainly there were a number of altars where Samuel sacrificed. Later in the book, chapter 16, when the Lord tells Samuel to go and to anoint David to replace Saul as king, you read in the second verse, this verse has often been discussed, by the way, from the ethical question it raises, but you see in the first verse, the Lord says to Samuel, and this is chapter 16, verse 1, "How long will you mourn for Saul, since I have rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil. Be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I've chosen one of his sons to be king." Samuel says, "How can I go? Saul will hear about it and kill me." And what's the Lord's response? "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have to come to Bethlehem to sacrifice to the Lord.'" So it must not have been unusual for sacrifices to have been offered in Bethlehem. In that light, Saul would not have realized what was going on. I won't get into the ethical issue that this raises right now, however. Okay, I see by the expressions on your face that you are interested in verse 2 of chapter 16, because it gets into the question, is it ever right to deceive someone? I think there are cases where there is no obligation not to deceive someone, and where one is not culpable for deceiving, particularly in the context of almost war, as it was here, or where there is an innocent life at stake. You have a higher obligation, it seems to me, to the other person involved than you do to tell the truth. Then you get into the question of what's the truth and what's a lie. These are definitional and semantic questions, and it gets very complicated at times. I don't think we can address that issue fully here. I've discussed this in Old Testament history, however. I don't think you can address that issue apart from the ninth commandment, where it says, "Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor." It's not just an abstract commitment to truth. It's you, and by your words, you are to protect your neighbor. That's your positive obligation. It seems to me, when you work out the implications of that, this kind of text is consistent with the view of the ninth commandment. There are other texts in the Old Testament that are to be taken in a similar vein as well. Now, you particularly get into that kind of thing, as I've said, in Old Testament history. Some of the Korean fellows that are here at the seminary know a lot about the war-type situation in Korea. And my wife grew up in the Netherlands, an occupied country. Her parents housed the Jews during the Second World War and protected them. You get that question. What if the SS, Secret Service, Hitler's SS, knocks on your door? What do you say? Do you say, "Here they are," or do you deceive them? I think it is your Christian responsibility to deceive them. That's not bearing false witness against your neighbor. Well, people can have different views on that. It's a tough question, but that's the way I think about it. In Walter Kaiser's book on ethics, he tries to make that distinction and say that it is never right to deceive, but in some cases you can conceal. I suppose this is something like saying the truth and nothing but the truth, but not always telling the whole truth. He uses an illustration where you can conceal. We may never know whether Samuel was questioned, saying, "What are you doing?" Samuel says, "I'm going to do that," and it's true. He was going to Bethlehem to offer a sacrifice, yet he's concealing the true intent and the true reason for going there. So he's deceiving Saul at the same time, but he's also telling nothing but the truth. He's telling the truth and nothing but the truth. He just isn't telling the whole truth, and I think there are times when that has to be done. There's a student question that we can't quite understand, but here's Vinoy's answer. That's a technicality, I think, because the end result is the same. He's led to believe one thing when in actual fact he is going for another reason. Even though technically you can argue that, is a distinction really worth a whole lot? Maybe it's worth something. Student says something else. Vinoy's answer. You see, Hodge says about a lie, even if you say something that doesn't correspond to reality, Hodge says that's not a lie if there's no obligation to tell the truth. So if you are not obliged to tell the truth, then it's not a lie. So then it depends how you define your terms, too. That will take us away from this important question, however, concerning altars. But the point is, there was an altar in Bethlehem. At this time, it doesn't seem unusual to go to Bethlehem and sacrifice, and one does not have to go to the tabernacle. See, this would still fit in with this area because Wellhausen would say at this point, before 621 BC, that you did have a multiplicity of altars. So he appealed to this as well. On the occasion when David was not at his place at Saul's table, this is chapter 20 of 1 Samuel, Saul excuses him initially on the assumption that he was unclean. This was on the occasion of the feast of the new moon day. So you read in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 26, that Saul said nothing that day, for he thought David wasn't there in his place, and something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean for the festivities. But the next day, we read, the same day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said to his son Jonathan, "Why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal yesterday or today?" And Jonathan answered, "David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go, because my family is observing a sacrifice in the town, and my brother has ordered me to be there. If I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers.' That is why he has not come to the king's table." Now, of course, it had been arranged by David and Jonathan previously that this was the response that would be made. But again, the point is that what we're discussing here is that Saul would have thought it perfectly normal for David to go to Bethlehem and to offer a sacrifice. He gave a legitimate excuse. Nobody sees a deviation from the law on that, respecting an altar. Now, those are some of the references that show multiplicity of altars. And some people respond and say that Deuteronomy chapter 12 says, quote, "When he giveth you rest," that's in verse 1 and verse 10. Verse 1 says, "These are the decrees and the laws you must be careful to follow in the land the Lord your God, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess as long as you live in the land." And verse 10 says, "You will cross the Jordan and settle in the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, and he will give you rest from all your enemies around you so that you will live in safety." Some people say that these were unstable times. That is, the times of Samuel and Saul. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 10 says that these laws that Moses have given are to be followed, quote, "when the Lord God gives you rest," end quote. Then 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 1 and 11 is pointed to. 2 Samuel 7 is the chapter where the Lord gives David the promise that he will build him a house. You read in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 1, and I'm quoting here, After the king was settled in his palace, and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies, etc., etc. Then in verse 10 it says, I will provide a place for my people Israel and plant them so they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. Wicked people will not oppress them any more as they did at the beginning and have done ever since the time I appointed leaders of my people Israel. So I will give you rest over all your enemies. Now, many people say that the conditions or the condition of rest did not develop where Deuteronomy 12 would apply until the time of David, when in 2 Samuel chapter 7 it says the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies. I don't think that solves the altar problem, in the sense that at that point the conditions are developed that would cause Deuteronomy chapter 12 to have applicability. Notice that Absalom, even after 2 Samuel chapter 7, he organized his revolution that was centered in Hebron. And in 2 Samuel chapter 15, verse 7, you read here, quote, At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, Let me go to Hebron to fulfill a vow I have made to the Lord. While your servant was living in Geshur, in Aram, I made this vow. If the Lord takes me to Jerusalem, I will worship the Lord in Hebron. So the king said to him, Go in peace. So he went to Hebron. End quote. And, of course, it was a deception, with Absalom representing himself to be going to Hebron to pay his vow and to worship the Lord and pay his vow, including offering a sacrifice. So there must have been an altar in Hebron. Absalom does that, but he does that with the agreement of David. There were still, it seems, with no questions involved, altars apart from the central altar in Jerusalem. Then also, if the rest that's talked about in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 10, refers to rest from external enemies, then Deuteronomy 12 would be applicable for only very brief periods, mostly during and after the time of Solomon. It seems much better to understand the term rest as referring not to external enemies, but internal. See, David's reference in 2 Samuel chapter 7 is to external enemies, but it seems better to understand the Deuteronomy chapter 12 reference as to internal enemies, and that rest was really achieved immediately after the conquest. Remember, the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh came across to help in the conquest. Then they went back to their territory east of the Jordan. You read in Joshua chapter 22, verse 4, and I'm quoting, Now that the Lord your God has given your brothers rest, as he promised, return to your homes in the land Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. End quote. Now rest was achieved immediately after the conquest. Those internal enemies were defeated. The Canaanites were defeated. And if that's the case, then that means that the law of Deuteronomy chapter 12 would be in effect and applicable during the time of Samuel and during the time of Saul. We can better look for it there than during the time of David. You also have that reference periodically through the book of Judges after victory has been achieved over some of these internal enemies. They were mostly internal in the book of Judges, with maybe one exception. If you look at Joshua chapter 21, verse 43, you read there, quote, The Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give to their forefathers. They took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their forefathers. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord handed all their enemies over to them. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to Israel failed. Everyone was fulfilled. End quote. That sounds like it's pretty absolute terms, yet you turn over to the first chapter of the book of Judges, and you find a number of tribes that say that they've not yet possessed this or that part of their territory. There's still much to be done. I think what's referred to in Joshua is that resistance was really broken, and the people were enabled to go in and settle down in their assigned territories. The conquest of the land was something that had really been accomplished, yet there was still work to be done. There's this reference to rest in Joshua chapter 22. The other thing is this. What about Exodus chapter 20, verses 24 to 26? We haven't looked at that yet, but let me read it. This is often called the law of the altar. The Israelites are told, and I'm quoting here, "Make an altar of earth for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, your sheep and goats and your cattle. Wherever I cause my name to be honored, I will come to you and bless you. If you make an altar of stones for me, do not build it with dressed stones, for you will defile it if you use a tool on it. And do not go up to my altar on steps, lest your nakedness be exposed on it." End quote. Now, what's the point of the regulations about the building of altars in Exodus chapter 20, verses 24 to 26? Why does it talk about uncut stones and an altar of earth? Was that meant only for the wilderness period? There's no indication of that. It seems to be meant for the time that Israel would come into the land of Canaan. You notice the regulations concern how the altars were to be built. Do not build it with dressed stones. Do not make steps, that sort of thing. It's to be an altar of earth. It also addresses the places where they are to be located. Quote, "Wherever I call my name to be honored," end quote. That's the NIV translation. That's where an altar can be built. The King James says, "In all the places where I record my name." It seems like there is to be some sort of divine sanction of a place. In other words, God chooses a place. Then there are these regulations about what type of altar will be there, but there's no indication about only one altar. It seems that the practice generally during the time of Samuel clearly corresponds with this legislation. There are a number of altars where Samuel sacrificed. So the question is, how do you harmonize these? Of course, Wellhausen addresses this issue. How do you harmonize Exodus chapter 20, verses 24 to 26, with Deuteronomy chapter 12? What Wellhausen did was to say there's a long period of development between the two laws. Exodus chapter 20 represents an early period where you have multiplicity of altars, and you had a long period of time, the time of Josiah, when you have centralization and thus move from one situation to another. The question is, have we really read Deuteronomy 12 correctly? If we think that Deuteronomy 12 requires one central altar, or one altar alone, is there only one legitimate place of worship? Does Deuteronomy 12 really demand that kind of centralization? If it doesn't, then of course there's no conflict between Exodus and Deuteronomy. If it does require one legitimate altar, then I think there is a conflict between Exodus and Deuteronomy. Let me give you what Hobart does with Deuteronomy chapter 12 in response to that problem. Specifically, how one relates Exodus chapter 20 to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 14, is a key verse that was just brought up. Quote, "But in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of your tribes," end quote. And then it goes on to say, and I quote again, "There shalt thou offer thy burnt offerings," end quote. I think for that statement we need to go back to verse 13, which says, and I'm quoting again, "Take heed to yourself that you offer not your burnt offerings in every place that you see," end quote. Don't offer your burnt offerings at every place you see. In contrast to that, in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of your tribes, there bring your sacrifices. The first impression might be that there's only going to be one place and one alone for sacrifices that are to be brought there. Hobart says that you can't stop with the first impression. The expression, quote, "one of your tribes," end quote, does not necessarily indicate only one. It may have the idea of the English, any. "In the place which the Lord shall choose" may be in any of your tribes. Now, the way he works this out is he uses several illustrations. He appeals to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 6, where you have this verse, quote, "If a Levite comes from one," that's the Hebrew word echad, "if a Levite comes from one, echad, of thy gates." Now, the idea is if a Levite comes from, quote, "any of your towns," that's the expression "from your gates," and that is the way the New American Standard Version translates it. You could translate it as follows, from one of your towns. But first, the idea is not that if a Levite comes from only one town, the idea is that if he comes from any of your towns. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 17, you have, speaking of the slave, and I quote here, he will dwell with you in any place which he shall choose within any of your gates, end quote. Again, the idea with any of your gates is within any of your towns. And here again, the Hebrew word echad, one, is to be understood as, quote, any, end quote. So it's any of your gates. So in chapter 12, verse 14 of Deuteronomy, you have the term one. That can be translated any. The other thing you have is in the place. That's singular with a definite article. It'll be argued, isn't that in the singular, and doesn't that mean only one place? If more than one was meant, why wouldn't you expect a plural? And again, Hobart's answer is not necessarily. This doesn't have to be the case. He appeals to Numbers chapter 16, verse 7. We read the following. And the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. End quote. The man, in this verse, is singular, with a definite article. And we read, whom the Lord chooses, he shall be the one who is holy. In the context of Numbers 16, the context is the uprising against the leadership of Moses by Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. In verse 7 you read, quote, the man whom the Lord does choose, he shall be holy. End quote. Again, the man is singular, but the question is, if the office of the priest or leader is to be confined to Moses and Aaron, or is it to be extended to 250 other people? You have a choice between two plurals. Is the leadership to reside with Moses and Aaron, or with the other 250 persons? The response is, quote, the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. End quote. The meaning is clear. It's the men, either Moses or Aaron, or Moses and Aaron. It's those men in either case. It's the 250 or the two. The article, you see, can be used in a distributive sense, not a restrictive sense. Let's also look away from the Pentateuch and take a look at the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 18, verse 4. And here we read, quote, the soul that sins will die, end quote. The soul, that is singular. That doesn't mean there's only one soul that's going to sin, that is going to die. The is distributive. The meaning is, any soul that sins will die. In fact, if you go back, you'll see we already looked at Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 6, and I'm quoting here, now if the Levites, and it should be any Levite, if the Levite comes from any of your towns. That doesn't mean one Levite only. That means any Levite. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 17, which we have already looked at, it says, the slave will go with you to any place. That's singular too, the slave, but it's distributive. It's not restrictive. You can't say that it refers only to one specific person who's a slave to the exclusion of all the others that is going to die in Ezekiel chapter 18, verse 4, or referring to slaves, one slave in the Deuteronomy passage, Deuteronomy 23. So, let's go back up here to Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 14, where it says, quote, but in the place which the Lord your God shall choose in any of your tribes, end quote. The place, singular, doesn't mean necessarily only one place. It can mean any place that the Lord shall choose in any of your tribes, and this is a possible and valid reading. That's the way Hobart reads that text. There are a number of those phrases in Deuteronomy chapter 12. I want to go back and look at some of them, but I think we better take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back and go further on with this. That is the end of Lecture 14 on Deuteronomy by Robert Vinoy of Biblical Theological Seminary.